You are listening to the Mystery Writers of America NorCal podcast. Find out more at mwanorcal.org. Leslie S. Klinger is the New York Times best-selling editor of the Edgar Award-winning The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes and Other Annotated Books and Anthologies. They are amazing works of published literature. He also co-edited with Laurie R. King the anthologies A Study in Sherlock, the Anthony Award-winning In the Company of Sherlock Holmes, and Echoes of Sherlock Holmes. Laurie R. King is the author of 25 novels and many other works, including 14 Mary Russell stories, the memoirs of a young woman who marries Sherlock Holmes. Laurie won the Edgar Award for her first novel, A Grave Talent. Their new book together is Anatomy of Innocence, Testimonies of the Wrongfully Convicted. The book was edited by Laura Caldwell and Leslie Klinger, and Laurie is one of the contributors. Thank you for joining me, Laurie and Les.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
I was thinking today of a man named Paul S. Virilio. He was a French philosopher in the mid-20th century. He came up with this idea of the accident, which is the idea that whenever you invent something, you also invent its accident. So, for example, Henry Ford, the greatest inventor of the 20th century for America, is also the author of the greatest slaughter of Americans in automobile accidents over the 20th century, and I think he's probably pretty much in the lead still. We have, in 200 years here in America, created an incredible machine. We call it the system of justice. Perhaps there is an accident in that machine as well. And that is why we have the Innocence Project. This is a really amazing project. Les, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came to be involved with this anthology?
Well, I think you've said it right, that the justice system has its accidents. But it used to be, first of all, back in the days when we had divine justice, when, you know, you could cast the runes or something and find out whether somebody was guilty or not, just like with the witches, you know, there couldn't be any mistakes because obviously it was divine. And that carried over to the human justice system, at least the myth that there were no mistakes, for centuries, to the point where really as recently as the 70s, I think we have judges saying, we can't have mistakes, or we have such a perfect system, it's not possible for there to be a mistake. But in fact, it's a human system. And it's a system with human law enforcement officials, human prosecutors, human judges, and human juries. And mistakes happen. This book is Laura's brainchild. It was a way for us to draw into the community of the Innocence Movement, a bunch of friends. Over the years, mystery writers, friends of ours, had said to Laura in particular and me, how can we help? And Laura said to me, you know, how can you help, Les? So she came up with the idea of this anthology. And we decided what's unique about it is not telling the stories of wrongfully convicted people, though there are other books that have done that. But what's unique is that we paired up wrongfully convicted individuals, who we call exonerees, with major thriller mystery writers to better tell their stories so that we could attract attention to the book and to the problem. We also had the idea that rather than try and tell the stories of 15 different people in full, it would be better to try and create a composite of the experience of an exoneree, a person who has been wrongfully arrested, gone through a trial, convicted, spent time in prison, ultimately found factually innocent and released from prison and now reentering society. So each of the chapters in the book covers a different stage of that arc, that typical experience. And we used a different exoneree for each chapter. So, for example, the first chapter is the arrest about a woman named Gloria Killian, as told to S.J. Ruzan. The second chapter is about David Bates. It's about his interrogation, as told to Sarah Paretsky. The third chapter is the trial, and that's Raymond Towler, and his story was told to Lori. And I'll let Lori talk a little bit about that.
Lori?
Yeah, when Les and Laura were trying to set this book up, they looked at their 15 writers and their 15 exonerees that they had settled on and tried to come up with the ideal match. That is, who is most likely to respond to this particular story? Who can dramatize it in a good way, that is, to really get to the meat of what this selection of that person's life is about? And they decided, in their wisdom — these are my editors, so I have no idea what was behind their decisions — but they decided that I would do best with a text. Now, I am a text-based sort of person. My background is dealing with theological texts. I write texts, mysteries. And so they set me to do Ray Towler's trial. I, of course, asked to see the text. I asked to see the transcript of the trial, which took some doing because it was 30 years old and not exactly something that's on everyone's shelf. And so eventually they did get it, and I read my way through it. And I was fascinated by how much story there was in this very thin transcription of dialogue. I mean, there's very little in a court transcript other than the words pronounced in the course of it. And yet you could read all of this fascinating, subtle interaction between the defense attorney and the prosecutor and the judge, and as each one attempts to outmaneuver the other. And I mean, I just found it fascinating as a piece of writing and as a thing that condemned a young man to spend 28 years behind bars. I found it outrageous and offensive and weirdly inevitable.
Les?
I was going to say, let's back up a second here and let me try and give you the 20,000 foot view of the problem. So we don't have accurate statistics about the quantity of innocent people in jail, but scholars think it's between 5% and 10% of the prison population. Now, we can be really proud as Americans that we have more people in prison per capita than any other country in the world. We have 2.3 million people in prison. One third of the women in prisons around the world are American women here in the United States. So we have this enormous prison population. If it's 5% that's innocent, that's 100,000 people languishing in prisons for crimes that they did not commit. We're not talking about people with whom there were procedural errors or things like that. We're talking about people who are factually innocent. There is a registry, a national registry of exonerations. We're now just over the 2,000 mark in terms of the number of people listed in the registry who have been exonerated since the early 1980s. And there's some surprises. I mean, one surprise is only 25% of people in the registry have been exonerated by reason of DNA evidence. Television, of course, makes it seem like, well, that's got to be the magic bullet and everybody's getting out on DNA. No. The more common causes are recanting of mistaken witness testimony, witnesses who positively identified somebody as being the killer, or the rapist, or whatever, who recanted later because they realized they made a mistake. In one case we were talking about the other day, there were 6 eyewitnesses, all of whom recanted, after it was demonstrated that they couldn't possibly have seen the interior of a car driving by in a drive-by shooting. Other reasons why people are wrongfully convicted and ultimately get out. One is false confessions.
That is the biggest one, I think, statistically, isn't
it? So false confessions, I mean, they're a bit unbelievable that people would confess to crimes they didn't do, but it happens with great regularity, and it happens in part because of the rules. The police are allowed to lie during the interrogation. Only recently have states like New York introduced mandatory videotaping now of interrogations. California doesn't have such a rule. And so there are abuses. In fact, the story we have in the book about the interrogation involved the infamous John Berge of Chicago and physical torture that was routinely going on with suspects. Inept defense counsel. Counsel who showed up drunk, who slept through the trial, things like that.
Or were just like the one in Laurie's trial.
Left something to be desired, yes.
Left something to be desired.
And then a significant element in all of these cases is what Michael Connelly calls tunnel vision. Unfortunately, in our justice system, there is an ethos that says it's all about convictions. It's all about arrests. It's not about finding the truth. And so when the police have a suspect in mind, that there is evidence pointing to that suspect, they start to block out the other evidence, sometimes intentionally, sometimes just subconsciously. They decide this is the suspect. They don't look at other possible suspects. The prosecutors do the same. And this has led to some disasters in terms of the convictions. Now, sometimes it's intentional. We've got cases of prosecutors who suppressed exculpatory evidence, knowingly suppressed it.
It's kind of mind-boggling to read these things, that these people, they have clear evidence that somebody was miles away.
Yes.
They have witnesses who are miles away, and they never let it not be known to the defense.
It interfered with their neat theory, and it was going to cost them the win. They had enough to win as long as that evidence didn't come out. Now, what's happening, there are some good signs. The rate of people being released seems to be increasing. We have the development in some counties of conviction review units that are being set up. Now, unfortunately, most of those are in-house units, meaning the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office has its own conviction review unit that reviews the Los Angeles County District Attorney cases. It's not an independent body looking at it. It's not like a peer review body that doctors have. But it's a start, and that's developing more and more locations, and some prosecutors are taking harder looks at some of their cases. But there's it's a problem for the prosecutors. When the prosecutor decides that they made a mistake, they get shunned by their brothers and sisters in the prosecutorial community. You know, it's like, how could you do that? How could you admit that we made mistakes? And that's really the biggest problem. The biggest problem is that it's a human system, mistakes are made, and people don't want to own up to them.
One of the things I thought was so wonderful in this book is, for one thing, the Kafka-esque nightmare feel of this. All of these stories have this thread running through them of people who know they're innocent, but are caught up in a machine which they can't control. And that sense of being unable to control your own life is really terrifying.
And that's something you really brought out in Ray Teller's case.
Yeah. I think as you read through the book, that is definitely the message, that is the takeaway of it could happen to me, because I mean, most of us do feel that, you know, this is just a really naughty mistake. And honestly, my guy, Ray Teller, thought this is one of those things that a black guy in his 20s has to go through in the world, and they'll find me not guilty, and I'll go on, and that'll be my life will continue.
That is a fatal attitude in our system.
Yeah, pretty much everybody in this book assumed that the system works. They assumed that this system is fair and there's no way they can find me. And I know I didn't do it. There's no way they can find me guilty.
Right. And their innocence often works against them because they don't get the legal help that they should have gotten right away. They talk too much. They try and be cooperative. And now 10% of the people in the exoneration registry are under 18 years old when they're first arrested. So, I mean, it's not surprising that they have these attitudes. They're not hardened criminals. These are kids. And the other part of the book, though, I mean, we can talk about the problems and sort of why they develop and all that, but the other part of the book, and I want Lori to talk about this too, is the discovery of these remarkable individuals. I mean, I've now met a number of exonerees, and Laura, of course, works with many of them, and they are the most incredible people. Somebody described them, maybe it was Barry Scheck, as the luckiest unlucky people in the world, but it's not really just luck. They have incredible strength of character. They have managed to focus their emotions, turn off their bitterness and anger, and survive. In some cases, Ray Teller, 28 years in prison, and
this was for a sex crime against a child. And you know that those are 28 really tough years because, I mean, a community of men in a hard prison is not going to be gentle on someone who is convicted of a sex crime against a child. And yet Ray is as Les said, not bitter.
I think that the what's interesting, too, is Les was talking about the arc of story that you created using different parts of stories. We get that sense that what Les and you are both talking about, that running through this story arc is this kind of strength of character that you really need to preserve. And what's interesting is to see it brought out in so many different ways, in so many different circumstances, and also at so many different income and societal levels. I mean, these are not just all people who are economically disadvantaged or living in a bad part of town. I mean, there are people who, for example, Gloria Killian.
Gloria Killian, Audrey Edmonds. These are not young black men.
No.
Although that is certainly the largest component of the people who are in the registry. Now, I mean, it's not going to be the case that everybody who is innocent has this strength of character. I mean, obviously, we don't know the stories of people who failed, the people who succumbed and said, you know what? Because, for example, when you come up for parole, The big criterion for parole is, are you repentant? So if you're innocent, you're not saying, you know, I've learned my lesson, I'm really sorry I did what I did, I'm a different person now. You're saying, I'm innocent. Well, the parole board doesn't like that. So there's got to be tremendous pressure on somebody who is wrongfully convicted and incarcerated to say, after 20 years.
I did it.
Maybe just, hey, you know what?
I'm sorry.
I'm never getting out of here unless I just say I did it. Maybe I should just say I did it and I'll get parole and I'll move on. We don't know about those people. They haven't made it into the registry. They haven't made it through to come to our attention. And of course, there are others who just gave up. They didn't try to do appeals. They just said, you know, I'll just do my time. And the sad part is, of course, as is typical of any social problem, is that there's inadequate resources to help people, and therefore even the Innocence Projects have to start to say to people, we can't help you, we can't take your case. You've only got 5 years left on your sentence. We can't take your case on because it might take 5 years to go through the process to get you out. Or there's other people who are only 10 years in, and they've got 20 years left on their sentence, and those are the ones we're going to focus on. There are, by the way, there are now something like 63 Innocence Projects around the country. San Francisco Bay Area has the NorCal Innocence Project, which is a terrific organization. That's a little different from Life After Innocence. Life After Innocence, which Laura started...
This is a really fascinating project.
Right, and it focuses almost uniquely. I mean, there's one or two other little organizations like hers, but focuses on helping the people who have gotten out and helping them reenter society. We talked the other day to a woman in San Diego. She had been wrongfully convicted of killing her boyfriend, and she was finally exonerated and released. And now she's going through applying for credit cards, and the credit companies have called her and say, well, where were you for the last 7 years? Well, I was in prison, you know. The fact that she's innocent doesn't really matter. They see the 7-year blank on her employment history. She, of course, lost her job. She lost, in that case, she lost her kids. I mean, her kids are, her kids were taken away from her, and her parents weren't allowed to step up to take care of the kids because she was a convicted felon, and they weren't going to have these rotten parents, grandparents, taking care of them. She can't get her nursing license back because she doesn't have an official certificate of innocence yet. Those are typical problems. I mean, imagine if somebody took away 20, 25 years of your life, right in the middle, starting at the age of 16, 18, 20.
When Ray, yeah.
You know, and you come out, you have no job skills, you have no Social Security benefits.
You don't know how to use a computer.
Right.
It's the legend of Sleepy Hollow.
Exactly.
Not. You know, one of the things that struck me about this book that's so powerful in this book is the power of story. To see the words strung together, to read and experience and immerse ourselves in these different people's stories, and then to put together this kind of patchwork quilt of a story, it's a really powerful experience. And having those stories, those actual words and the beginnings, middles, and ends to them, that makes a big difference in understanding the impact of this on the individuals.
Well, thank you. I mean, Laura describes this as we wanted people to feel like what it was like to be in the skin of an exoneree. And I think the book, I hope the book does that. I should mention, I should have said this up front, by the way, this was a project, the proceeds from the book are going to Life After Innocence. The authors got a nominal fee for writing. The editors took nominal fees. The exonerees took nominal fees. And so I've been telling friends, buy 3 or 4 copies, you know, give them to your friends, because A, we're raising money for Life After Innocence, but B, we also want to spread the word. We want people to pay attention, as we used to say in the 60s, question authority, and wonder about whether those articles in the paper that say so-and-so is guilty, so-and-so is arrested, etc., what is the evidence? Could it be that there was a mistake made? We're not saying that everybody in prison is innocent. We're not saying every prosecutor is corrupt, every police officer is corrupt. We're saying mistakes happen, and when they happen, they should be dealt with.
The new book, edited by Les Klinger and including the work of Laurie R. King, is Anatomy of Innocence, Testimonies of the Wrongfully Convicted. Thank you for joining me, Laurie and Les.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Mystery Writers of America NorCal podcast. Find out more at mwanorcal.org.